K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And along with Mel, K2 KEY. We're going to start something called the technical net. Technical net tonight probably is not going to run as long as usual. I'm guessing it. Mel and I are going to try to quit at about 10 o'clock instead of midnight. Mainly because field day was pretty rough on us. So we stayed awake around the clock. You'll be hearing more about that. So anybody who's had any kind of an experience at field day, good, bad, or whatever, otherwise, we welcome you to come along and tell us what it was like for you, which is fun for you. So that's one of the main things we'll be discussing tonight, as well as anything else people want to discuss that is of interest to radio amateurs. Usually electronics, usually wireless communication type electronics, but not always. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and me your call letters, your name, and if you've got a question or a comment, you follow that with a yes. And if you don't have a question or a comment, you follow that with a no. So give us your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening. My name is Dick.
W2OSR? Yes.
Okay, we got Bob and a double. Who is the other person? W2OSR was one. Who was the other person who tried to sign in?
WB2HWW, yes.
Okay, Howie. So we got Howie and Bob. Anyone else to sign in?
KC2MDT, Steve, no questions.
Okay, we got
WF2N, Paul, no questions.
Okay, we got Steve and Paul. Anyone else?
And a good evening again. This is K2KEY, Long Pond Notebook.
He sounds a little bit tired. Can't understand that. Hope to talk to you about that a little later. That was Mel. Anyone else? Okay, the mobile station, we only got about 20% of that, but we know there's a mobile station who I think said no questions at this time. One last call. Anyone else to sign it? Give me your call letters and name and a yes or no at this time. Okay, there being none, Bob, W2OSR, you probably have a question, and also squeeze in there. Where did you go for field day? Who did you meet? What happened? Did the generator keep running? W2OSR, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, good evening, Dick, W2OSR.
Well, my question sort of has to do with field day, but I started out Friday loading up a van for the Limark field day, and then Saturday morning at 7 o'clock I was down there in Watchor helping to set up about 1 in the afternoon to head over to the NASA Amateur Radio Club where I tried to work 6 meters without great success because 6 wasn't working too well. But the question was, I built 2 dipole antennas for Limark for field day. They were fan dipoles used in an inverted V configuration. I had trouble getting the VSWR down on 80 meters to something less than 2 to 1. With a tuner, they probably worked fine. But they seemed to have a reactive component that was inductive, probably due to the length of the wire, and I'm curious what I could have done to help bring that down a bit.
Okay. In the case of a fan dipole, I'm going to make a guess, Bob, but your fan dipole covered 80, 40, 20. So you had a dipole for each one of those all connected together in parallel. And the way fan dipoles work is that the 40-meter dipole will see the wire of the 80-meter dipole and be affected a little bit. If you're a purist, it'll require a little bit of length adjustment. The same thing with the 20-meter one. But the 80-meter dipole, for the most part, does not see the 40 or the 20, if that's the structure you built. And there's a slight exception to what I just said. I just realized it.
Yep.
And you're going to get a beautiful image of this. If you read an article I wrote, it's on the internet, And the easiest way you can find the article is to Google WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. You Google that set of call letters of Dr. Tom Williams. He's got a microwave website. And I keep forgetting, his website is wa1mba.org or .net or .com. I keep forgetting which one it is. But by Googling those call letters, you'll find it. You go to his microwave website. At the bottom is an article about impedance matching Yagis. When you impedance match a Yagi, you're impedance matching the driven element. And the driven element is a dipole. And what you're going to discover is that by simply adjusting the length of any dipole, making it shorter than half wave or longer than half wave, if it was exactly half wave, a reasonable diameter wire in completely free space, a dipole would be a 72 ohm resistor, period. But real dipoles, in the case of a Yagi, that's a parasitic element nearby, real dipoles, in the case of a fan dipole, have some other fanned elements nearby, a 20 and a 40 meter dipole in my case, in my little example. Even if it's nothing but an 80 meter dipole, the dipole is mounted some distance above ground and you're getting ground reflection. And it may be near some trees and near gutters of the house and whatever. So there's a bunch of things that will do minor perturbations of the dipole. Not major, minor. But still, what you'll discover when you look at the graphs that go with that article, and by the way, you can see these graphs in any good issue of Antenna Engineering Handbook. First one was by my good buddy Henry Jasek, 1981, McGraw-Hill. That was the first edition. Second and third edition were by Mr. R.C. Johnson of, I think it was Ohio University. Second and third edition. And the fourth edition, just published a week ago, they all have Chapter 3 or Chapter 4, depending on which issue, has a beautiful set of graphs of what happens when you make a monopole longer or shorter. Bear in mind that a dipole is a pair of monopoles back-to-back. Simple as that. So, here's what you'll discover. As you make the dipole shorter than half-wave length, instead of being 70 ohms, it goes down to 60, 50, 40, you go all the way down to 1 ohm for the resistive component by simply making the dipole shorter. I'm only speaking of the resistive component. Making the dipole longer than half-wave length, you'll start off at 70, and it goes to 100, 200. You can make the resistive component of the dipole go to 4,000 ohms resistive simply by making the dipole longer. So, the bottom line of the first half of the story is you adjust the length of the dipole and you can make the resistive component any number that suits your fancy. However, the second graph of the article will show you that as you go shorter than half wavelength, we'll have a mountain of capacitive reactants left over, which can be corrected. And if you make it even a skosh longer than half wavelength, you'll have a mountain of inductive reactants left over. Longer is better, simply because it's very easy to create a shunt capacitor at the center of the dipole. So, by way of the article, take any dipole on planet Earth, fat, skinny, feeding it with delta match, gamma match, T match, folded dipole, whatever your favorite method of feeding is. Take any dipole that has ever been created by mankind. Curved, straight, inverted V, square, loop, whatever. Any dipole-like structure. Once you're smart enough to understand what those two graphs are telling you, you have independent control of the resistive component, independent control of the reactive component. So without using an antenna tuner, by using very simple techniques, you can make any dipole 1.000121 standing wave ratio, if that's what you desire to do. The hardware to do that, the technology to do that, the understanding to do that, is within your grasp. So, I didn't answer your question. I didn't feed you a fish, but I think I almost taught you how to go fishing. You probably got some further questions here, Bob. W2SO OSR, the former KC2MWA, better known as Bob to his buddies.
Now, adding capacitance to the antenna would wipe out some of the problems I was having from the inductance. Inductance created by the length of the wire. Curious thing, though, and I will mention this, is that we use two different methods of connecting to the antenna. This was an 80 and 40 meter fan dipole. It didn't have 20 on it. 20 meters on both antennas was acceptable. It was under about 1.7 on one and 1.5 on the other. On 40. That's not too bad. The one antenna that we used a one-to-one balun on has a higher VSWR. The ones that we just simply took the coax and made about 5 or 6 turns of coax to keep the RF off the outside has a better match. I haven't figured that one out yet, but maybe you've got an idea.
Yes, I do, Bob. Impedance matching and baluning are slightly separate structures, but they cross-couple. And by the way, I'm suddenly realizing now that I've already said that when you're feeding an 80-meter dipole, a fan dipole, the 40 is not doing anything to you. Well, as far as the tip reactance is concerned, that's absolutely true. As far as what's going on at the center, I suddenly realized that the 40-meter dipole is a small capacitance left over at the center of the 80-meter dipole. That capacitance would force you to make the 80-meter dipole a little bit longer to make the reactances come out right, but the resistance is going to go up above 70 ohms when you do that, if it was up to free space. At each altitude, you're going to get some ground reflection that's going to make that higher and lower, but at least you know which way to go. And the reason why I like longer is because it's very easy to make a shunt capacitor across the center of a dipole. When you're doing it at VHF, UHF frequencies, when you're doing it as an experimental setup, just to prove you can do it, if it's a printed circuit, 900 megacycle dipole, you lay a piece of scotch tape over the center of the dipole, you lay a piece of copper tape on top of the scotch tape, and that's a poor man's capacitor. And you start peeling away the copper tape, and then as you do that, the shunt capacitance you're making there decreases, and when your standing wave indicator or your network analyzer or your antenna analyzer shows the right display, you stop. And maybe you don't leave it that way. You just prove to yourself you can make perfect impedance match with these gimmick capacitors made out of copper tape and scotch tape as the insulator, as the dielectric. It works very well at 900 megs. I guarantee it's going to work at lower frequencies. And then for you to figure out how many picofarads that gimmick capacitor is and make something more permanent that's weatherproof for the real antenna, like a chunk of coax cable as a open-circuited stub, is an easy way to make a very high-Q, very high-performance, high-power capacitor. So, impedance matching techniques that force the antenna end to be higher and the feed end to be lower is the easier way to go, because to make a variable capacitor in the center of a dipole by gimmick is very easy. To make a variable inductor at the center of a dipole by gimmick is a little bit more difficult, so I tend not to go in that direction. I know this is not quite on the subject you're asking me, but when you go to that article, at the bottom of the first page of Dr. Tom Williams of the A1MBA's website, you'll see that the impedance matching, a significant number of people who have over the last year finally read that article, a significant number of people come back to me, write me an email with all kinds of accolades to it saying, why the hell hasn't somebody told me this sooner? That by very simple techniques, I can make a perfect impedance match of any dipole, whether it's part of a Yagi, whether it's by itself, whether it's part of a fan, I'm not aware. I can make perfect impedance. Why hasn't anybody told me this? It's interesting that I tried getting this article published in two separate ham radio magazines and two separate online publications who both thought the subject was boring and turned it down. The people who read the article think, what the hell is the matter with these people?
so there's conflicting opinion on this. Some people think a dipole is so basic, so mundane, so boring, that they don't want to hear anything about it. Other people, like yourself, are a little bit more of a purist, want the dipole to perform better. But now, there's another side of this coin, Bob, and that is, are you gilding the lily? Are you being a perfectionist? Are you being a purist? Are you being a scientist? A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The average guy within the sound of you and my voice would be horrified, saying, how the hell can you tolerate something so bad? And many a transmitter will trip out and do some funny things and cut back in power at even, 1.7 to 1 or better, or higher. But a 2-to-1, as bad as it sounds, if the transmitter was an ideal 50-ohm load, and it's not, all the reflective power would be reabsorbed by the transmitter, and so a 2-to-1 disrupt would lose you exactly half a dB of forward available transmitted power. That's 1/12 of 1 S-unit of difference in signal strength if the guy has a well-calibrated S-meter on the other end. 1/12 of 1 S-unit, half a dB, to the 6 dB per S-unit. Hard to measure except with good laboratory equipment. So the thing we all lose sleep over, a 2-to-1 disrupt, a very minor perturbation in the real world of antennas. A 1.5 to 1 Biswan is something like 2/10 of a dB of loss. So when we are looking for better match, we're either doing it to keep our transmitter happy so it doesn't trip out, because modern-day solid-state transmitters without the tuning and loading controls we used to have are not very tolerant of any substantial Biswan beyond about 1.5 or so. So that's our usual motivation. And a hell of a lot of people think that, gee, any reflective power is intolerable. Every dose is an overdose. Every reflection is undesirable, is what they think. And it's extreme. When you zoom back a little bit and realize what's going on, it ain't anywhere near that bad. No matter what you do with the dipole, zigzagging it up and down, left and right, putting loading coils and whatever, until you get really extreme, it's very difficult to make any change to the radiation pattern. You got too little real estate, too few wavelengths to work with, you don't have the resources, the exact words that the antenna mavens use, you don't have the steering moment. You don't have enough steering moment, you don't have enough length to really affect the pattern. The biggest moment you have is the height above ground. That affects the vertical takeoff angle. But now, to get to your original last question, I'm finally getting back to it, that is, in the ideal world, we'd like to have a perfect balance. The signal flowing down the coax cable, unbalanced transmission line, goes onto that wire of the dipole, gets radiated to space, and the wire itself of the transmission line doesn't re-radiate for you. Well, it takes a good balance at the end of the dipole to stop that re-radiation of the transmission line, so the signal flowing down the outside of the cable. Put a good balance on there, or put a four-man balance by a few turns of coax cable, which is a series inductor, as far as the outside current is concerned, no effect on the inside current, that stops that from happening. However, although we fear current flowing down the outside of the coax cable, and the reason we fear it is that if that cable happens to go down the elevator shaft of your apartment building, and it goes by a couple of your downstairs residents, and it goes close to their television set, because of the radiation of the outside of the cable, you may get some television turn. So for that reason, it's good to stop it from happening. In the extreme case, if your cable just happens to be a resonant length, the transmitter can become hot, and if it was a D104 hike and you go up close to it, a little spark jumps from the microphone to your lip as you talk, and that's a bit unpleasant. However, that's the undesirable part of radiation to the cable. But our real motivation in space here is to radiate that signal out there somewhere. And if the transmission line does some of the radiation, as well as the thing we call antenna, in many cases that's good. When the transmission line does some radiating, it is an additional load to the antenna. If the antenna happened to be 70 ohms resistive component, and you've got some radiation going on of the outside of the coax cable in shunt, bringing it down to 50 ohms, the possibility exists that the radiation of the cable gives you a better impedance match. And the cable radiated is helping you radiate that signal out of space. In the case of a field day operation, you don't really care. Is it the 14-gauge wire radiating, or is the opposite side of the coax radiating, or both radiating? As long as the signal goes out there and hits the ionosphere, it's going to make you and the guy you're talking to happy, in general. So, as bad as it sounds, not having a perfect balance, in some cases, it's good, depending on what you're trying to do. That's what I think you've seen, Bob. W2OSR, H2RIW in the test net.
Okay, KQRIW, W2SR. Just one last quick question, and then I'll let you move on to the next person. How would a piece of 400 ohms wind lead work coming off the center to give me the capacitance I need? I realize the coaxial cable, for length, I would probably get more out of it for a shorter length.
Okay. Let me think of the formula now.
Yes.
X equals E0 transmitter. Capacitor reactant, as long as your length of cable is less than 90 degrees long, as long as the far end of the stub is an open circuit, how many ohms of reactance you're going to get out of it is that formula. X sub C equals Z0 times tangent of theta. Z0 is either 50 ohms if it's coax, or 400 ohms if it's your lateral line, or 600 ohms if it's your open wire line. That's the Z0. Multiply that by tangent, a trigonometric function that's on your handheld calculator, tangent of theta. Theta is electrical length of the stub in degrees. Quarter wavelength is 90 degrees. Include velocity factor when you're talking about length. The electrical length, not mechanical length. So if your 400 ohm ladder line happens to have a velocity factor of 90%, and you make it 2 feet long, 2 feet divided by 0.9, I'm not sure of the exact number, it's probably going to be something like 2.2, you will have electronically 2.2 feet of length of cable when you've got 2 feet real, and then by knowing the wavelength that you're working with, if in my particular example the wavelength was 4 feet, let me make the electrical length about 2 feet, let me make the wavelength come out 8 feet. 2 feet is 1/4 of 8 feet. 1/4 of 360 degrees is 90 degrees. So in that example, if it was an 8 foot wavelength and I got 2 feet electrical of cable, that would be 90 degrees, and I plug in 90 degrees for that formula. Well, that's the one place where your handheld calculator will give you a crazy number, because the tangent of 90 degrees is infinity. But you can always plug in 89.9 or 90.01, if you know what I mean, to get around that problem and start getting an answer. When the wavelength of... So, the bottom line is, when you're using 400 ohm cable instead of 50 ohm cable, the desirable length to give you your calculated reactance that you're going to get from the Tom Williams article, so to speak, the KQRIW article on Tom Williams' website, is a slightly different length of 400 ohm cable than 50 ohm cable, but you choose the right length and you will get the exact reactance you want. Is one better than the other? That's a good question. I could say that the coax cable is better shielded and it's better weatherproofed, as long as you put some kind of plastic adhesive at the end so water doesn't flow up the open end of the cable. The twin lead is higher in Q, will take a higher amount of power before it arcs over, but you're not going to run that many kilowatts, so that doesn't matter. The twin lead, the 400 ohm ladder line, on a day when you've got a lot of rime ice in the wintertime, it'll change its characteristics a lot faster than the coax would. But that's a minor perturbation, that HF frequency. I don't think you've got to worry about it. And that rime ice on your antenna only happens once per 5 years, so I wouldn't worry about that one. So, which is more desirable? There's many ways to do it. You choose the one that you like the most. I will admit that the 400 ohm ladder line is a more balanced approach. So if you've got a perfect balance, you don't want to disturb the balancing function. You don't want to have any RF energy flowing down the outside of your transmission line. Then once you put on that perfect balance, and you do the impedance matching with the 400 ohm ladder line stub, it'll be a little bit more pure. But these are very minor details. But I think you see here, your problem, Bob, is that you've got at least four ways to solve the problem, and you're going to be in a quandary as to choosing which one you want to go. W2OFR, K2RIW in the thick
man. Okay. Just going to go up here. K2RIW.
Antenna, dipole antenna. I think he invented the thing somewhere around 1880. 1970 or so, you know, the dark ages of wireless. And here we are, 137 years later, teaching each other how to do it better. The most basic of all antennas. If I ask a few of these tricky questions about dipoles, what happens with length, what happens with pattern, how do you impedance match it, I can go down all the electronic engineers out of all the good schools that are working for the companies I've worked for, ask them a few questions, and it becomes immediately obvious they're not comfortable with that subject. It doesn't give them a warm and fuzzy feeling. 130-year-old antenna. It's been around forever. Lots and lots of generations and lifetimes it's been around. The most basic of all antennas. You would think every electronic engineer that works with wireless circuits would have that thing burned into his brain and know everything there is to know about it. The average electronic engineer, I think, knows 10% of what he would like to know about a dipole. I don't know how we got here from there, but I find that fascinating. Okay, let's see what Howie's got. WB2HWW, K2RW. You got Howie? Okay, maybe Howie got called away. Steve said he had no questions. Well, let's give Steve an opportunity. KC2FDP. Right now, Steve, you're number one on the runway. K2RIW in the deck net.
Yeah, I am. Good. K2RIW.
Okay, so hold on, Steve. How are you got it?
It's good. Good morning. You know, some people play around with horizontal and vertical antennas for 10-meter FM. Not me, but if they're at the horizontal antenna port bed. I want to know, in a closed loop, what is the impedance? A full wave loop, is that 100 ohms or 300 ohms? And it's 1,005 or 1,010 for the formula.
Okay. The formula, I'm not going to answer that question, whether it's 1,005 or 1,010, because the biggest variable there is what's the diameter of the wire. And how squared off did you make the corners? There's a bunch of variables there that will make a finer perturbation. Now, the exact impedance of a loop, I should know, and I don't. Mel probably does, because he's worked with loops. Each of the good antenna books, antenna engineering handbooks, has a section on loop antennas. That's going to help. There's a small section on loop antennas in the ARO antenna manual, antenna handbook. I am guessing it's higher than 300 ohms. But I'm not positive of that. And that's the resistive component you're talking about. Most people, when they build a loop, go one of two ways. Either they make a horizontally polarized full wave loop called the four square, that's parallel to the ground, the plane of it, and they try to bring it up high with four towers. That's one approach to a loop. The other way people build a loop, usually they're using it for direction finding, and they build a loop approximately a tenth of a wavelength circumference, and then electronically tune out the reactance that's left over. And that gives them a good direction-finding antenna. Sometimes they add a probe to it to make the bidirectional characteristic a little bit more monodirectional, so they don't have the ambiguity. And some people make the loop multiple turns, and there's advantages and disadvantages. The hard part we're all going to have to settle on. Mel is getting all kinds of hate mail from people who think that we're making up stories that a tenth of a wavelength diameter loop is capable of giving you, in reception, the full performance of a full one wavelength diameter loop. Almost identical gain. Of course that sounds crazy. And we're getting hate mail because we say that. I can point to you some theory that there will confirm it. Mel's made some measurements that confirm it. We see it. And so, you can see I don't know the exact answer to your question, but I can tell you some places where you can go, where you can get the answer. You're also a guy who's got access to some good instrumentation, Howie. So, for you to build a VHF version just to study it in your laboratory, build a version that's a 70 centimeters, study it, and then build an 80 meter version if you want. It's very easy to do. The nicest thing about antennas that I've ever discovered is that take any antenna you've ever heard of the 5,000 kinds of antennas. I don't care if the antenna was made for 100 kilohertz, 160 meters, 10 meters, 10 gigahertz, or 100 gigahertz. No matter what antenna you build, build whatever frequency region antenna is convenient for your particular material, tune it up, make it work the way you like. Then, if you scale every single dimension as a function of wavelength to your new frequency, I don't care if it's higher or lower, scale every single dimension, you will get the exact same performance, the exact same gain, the exact same pattern, the exact same impedance, and 98% of the time, the exact same efficiency. So, if you're studying an antenna, choose a frequency region that gives you the size of antenna you can easily build in your laboratory, tweak it up to your heart's content, then scale it to your favorite frequency, and don't worry about the scaling factor. Except for the ground reflection, whatever you're going to get when you build the real outdoor one, you'll get the exact same performance of the real antenna. Go to B2HWW, K2LIW on the tech deck.
Okay, because some people found it to be 100 ohms, some people found it to be 300. Well, what I'm looking to do is, I don't know if I'm going to build it or get like an M squared or a halo or a squirrel. I want to get something. I want to try using an omnidirectional loop for a 10 meter receive antenna, around 29 megs.
If you truly want omnidirectional, then you do not want, let me think about this for a second, full wave, M wave each side. Now, you're going to get a pattern that's got a wow to it. In other words, when you tweak the antenna in azimuth, you're going to have peaks and valleys of gain in azimuth if you build the loop anything beyond approximately a tenth of a wavelength. When you keep the loop small in circumference, like a tenth of a wavelength, with a slight exaggeration, you can say that the current around the loop is constant everywhere, and you get a truly omnidirectional pattern when the loop is laying parallel to the ground, and you care about horizontal polarization. Keep the loop small and resonate it electronically, and you have an omnidirectional pattern, real omnidirectional. I didn't say it's got gain, it's got the gain of a dipole, of a small dipole, so it's an omnidirectional pattern. Make the loop any bigger than that, and everybody wants to make the loop bigger because they're positive it's going to have more capture area and it's going to have more gain. They happen to be dead wrong, but that belief is so ingrained, so burned into the genes of everybody's brain, that when you make the loop bigger, it's going to have more gain. Between 0.1 wavelength and 1 wavelength, it's almost not true. Make the loop 40 wavelengths in circumference, and you're starting to build a traveling wave structure, a little bit rhombic right, and yes, you're going to get some real peaks of the gain in certain directions. And if you've got that much real estate to do it, really make it into a rhombic. But if you truly want omnidirectional, keep it small. And the motivation to go from 0.1 to 1 wavelength, because you think you're going to get more gain, and you're only going to pick up half a dB more, you're putting up a lot more wire, a lot more effort to gain half a dB, and you're going to gain a somewhat lumpy pattern. Are you sure that's where you want to go? Lots and lots of guys are going there because they're all telling each other this tale, this story. I get a lot of flack when I call it an old wives' tale. The best thing I can think of to call it. So the B2HWW, H-U-R-I-W in the tech net.
Well, basically what it is, we want this antenna to be used for DF, for skip on 10 meters, you know, to be used in an FM repeater, where you have basically the antenna horizontal to the plane, mounted on a pole, and, you know, they got M squares, they got, antennas that are slightly longer, slightly shorter than it. Basically, I do want to go with a loop because I want a DC grounded type antenna, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, the loop is nice and DC grounded. And because you want a DX antenna, you think you want more gain. And you think the bigger diameter or bigger circumference loop is going to have more gain. Everybody believes that. I'm strongly challenging that. Mel and I are challenging that. His measurements are challenging that. My reading of the good books is challenging that. But all the flack we get, the hate mail we're getting on this subject, means that the people can't accept it. I will admit there's one disadvantage of making the 10th wavelength circumference loop. It is higher in Q than the one wavelength loop. But, and will that Q be so high that with the, what is it, 200 kc of offset between transmit and receive on a 10 meter repeater, will it cover the 200 kc? I know electronically you can make that happen. You can make the transmitter happy and the receiver happy simultaneously by putting the right impedance match network after the transmitter and in front of the receiver, you know what I mean? So you can make that happen. But the antenna, when you make it smaller, it's more Romney, no change in gain, more Romney, but it is higher in Q, more narrow band. A little more careful tuning is required. And in the case of the square loop, the M squared square loop, which I've used a 2 meter version of that, Mike Stahl, who is the inventor of that thing, and I can't think of the name of the town he lives in, California right now, he lives in the Mojave Desert, where it's dry as all hell, and as such, he thinks it's a great antenna. Whenever I get water on that square loop 2 meter antenna, the VizRock goes sky high immediately, particularly with snow, ice, and water that I had when I was up at the Volmer Development Center in Utica, New York. I was making lots of trips with that antenna on top of my station wagon, and the standing wave ratio got so high that my my Mirage Baker, 1016 amplifier went crazy and would trip out with thermal overload. I think I was getting something like a 6-to-1 standing wave ratio when that antenna got wet. And I tried a couple of simple techniques to try to make that stop happening. Boy, that was a problem. So the M squared square loop is a high Q antenna, and it can't tolerate raindrops in the way you buy it a few years ago. I don't know if you modified the design. I remember writing some letters to him, and he said, what are you complaining about? Well, he's living in the desert, he doesn't have rain, and he thinks I'm crazy. Back to you, Ali.
By the way, bandwidth is not a problem. You do want a tight bandwidth because you're going to be using it, split site, and you want the antenna to not to be broadband and pick up signals because you want the receiver to be fairly selective. So, I'm wondering, with a half-wave loop, I want to go DC grounded. So, obviously, the shorter, the smaller the antenna, the lower the impedance if it's a complete loop, if I make it into a loop. That means it's a DC loop. So I assume that I can look that up in a book and find out exactly what size the antenna would have to be as a loop to give me 50 ohms. The only thing that I would have to worry about is the inductance and capacitance.
Yep. I recommend, if you truly want omnidirectional pattern, I recommend you choose the circumference that gives you the pattern you want. Anything less than half-wavelength circumference. Half-wavelength circumference, I think, is one of the circumferences where the reactive component goes to zero, but you're going to have some pretty ugly resistive number. I'm not sure what the number is. I'm going to pick a number out of the air. It might be 150 ohms. And on a 50-ohm transmission line, that would be about a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. And you might not be happy with that. So one way or the other, no matter what diameter you choose, you're not going to get 50 ohms resistance with no reactance left over. There's no magic diameter in the loop antenna that's going to give that to you with conventional feeding techniques. Now, there's all kinds of ways you can shunt feed it with a gamma rod, T-match, and whatever. All the ways you can feed a dipole, you can feed a loop, all of those ways. So one way or the other, you're going to use another structure to do the feeding or another structure to do the impedance matching. And maybe you're going to put it in a small weatherproof box alongside of the antenna. So you have the instrumentation to do the impedance matching. You have the books in front of you to choose the circumference that gives you the omni pattern. You're going to be doing impedance matching no matter what. I think you've got the raw ingredients for the antenna. You just got to crack the books and turn the crank, if you know what I mean, Howie. But back to you, Howie.
Gregor, I might give that guy Mike a call, M squared. Let me ask you a question. Even on 10 meters, I want to see if he makes it. I'm not looking to reinvent the wheel. I'm just looking to play around with some horizontal antennas because I'm going to put up a couple of different receive sites. All right. Thank you very much, Dick. But I will tell you that some people have done some experiments with beams and verticals, and I found out that horizontal antennas work a lot better for DX as on 10 meters. They tend to get rid of a lot of the local noise, and they tend to make the receiver work better, tend to get better DX, you know, better signal recovery, every signal on E-skip. K2RIW,
WD2HWW. Yeah, the Blue Lord Handbook, W6SAI, in his VHF handbook, very popular in the mid-60s and 70s, he says that over and over again. When it comes to real DX on VHF frequencies, everybody keeps rediscovering that horizontal polarization is slightly better. The trees are more vertical, so they don't give you as much shielding effect from horizontal. Noise tends to be more vertical polarized, particularly power line noise, less horizontal, and that's opposite of common sense, but I can explain that one to you. So when it comes to true DX, horizontal polarization always is a little bit better. The problem is, if your 10-meter repeater desires to talk to mobiles, making horizontal polarization on an automobile at 10 meters is a little more troublesome. There's a zillion brands of vertical whip antennas with and without loading coils that I can buy for my automobile. The number of horizontally polarized antennas I can buy for my automobile is considerably smaller. I guess there are cloverleaf loops. And by the way, you guys can help me in two places. One, I do remember, and I think it was the front cover of QSD magazine, I think it was 5 or so years ago, there was an antenna that I called the Texas Longhorn Mobile Antenna. Maybe it was called the Texas Steer Antenna. It was a bent dipole-like thing on a mobile, on a recreation vehicle, as I remember, where the center of the dipole was essentially over the top of the windshield of the car. The dipole went left and right toward the starboard and port side of the car. When it reached the side of the car, the roof, it bent at a 90-degree angle and then went parallel to the gutters of the car toward the back of the car. So it looked like the horn on a longhorn cow. And I called it the Texas Longhorn or the Texas Steer Antenna. And there was an article in, I thought QSD, could have been QEX. I don't think it was Ham Radio. I don't think it was CQ Magazine, but that's where I thought it was. I want to find that article on that antenna. I need that information. I did a web search on ARRL with all the word combinations I could find. The antenna doesn't exist. I then went down their list of every single mobile antenna in the last 20 years. Didn't find it. I haven't done a Google search yet on Texas Longhorn Antenna or Texas Deer Antenna or whatever the heck it was called. If anybody knows about that article, please sign in and give me that information. And Mel will write you a great big check for that information, for the filters. That's one piece of information I'm looking for. Another piece of information I'm looking for is I've got a need for quarter-inch diameter hardline coaxial cable. I own the coaxial cable, quarter-inch hardline, Teflon type. You know what UT-141 looks like. Well, there's a UT-250, uniform tubes, 250. It's got copper outer sheath, Teflon dielectric, and the silver-plated copper semiconductor. I've got that hardline cable, which I've got to use for a project. But I want to put a type N connector on the end of it. I don't care if it's a male type N or a female type N. I want to put a type N connector on the end of quarter-inch hardline cable. Where do I get that connector? Probably a Sonoron or a Crimpon or whatever. I don't know where to get one of those. So those are two questions I throw out to the net. Now back to you, Howie, for any comments so far. WB2HWW, K2RIW.
You probably get the connector from Tesco. You got a Tesco catalog. And as far as the, nodal, that's why you run a vertical and horizontal antenna. You run two receivers into a building. You select from two different sites. You do diversity reception. That's not a problem. When you have a mobile that's within ground wave, he comes in on the vertical antenna. When the mobile is horizontal, out in the range or DX station, he comes in on the receiver that's on the different antenna. Now, you talk about different antennas. I remember growing up in the, you know, 70s and even the late 60s, I remember the Halo, the Big Wheel, the Global Leaf. They had the Big Wheel on 6, I had them on 6. Which antenna did you like the best, Dick? They had the Big Wheel, they had the Global Leaf, and there were a bunch of different antennas were made by Chris Kraft and a couple of the other guys out there.
Yeah, I never ran a 6-meter Halo antenna, although some of my friends did. When it comes to mobile horizontal vertical polarization, I told you guys a number of times that for a solid 2 years, every weekend or every other weekend, I was traveling up to Utica, New York with my station wagon automobile, and I had a pair of 2-meter antennas on the roof, a vertical 5/8 wave whip and a horizontally polarized M-squared square loop, both on 2 meters. I'm talking on single sideband on 2 meters. And I was talking to can't forget his phone letters now. The guy in southern New Jersey. He's a big man on 2 meter single sideband. Anyhow, he's in southern New Jersey, Tabernacle, I think it is. And I'm driving up to Utica. And at times when I get up to Utica, I'm 200 miles from him, airline distance. And we're holding a QSO all the way. Yeah, he's running a moon bounce antenna and 500 watts or a kilowatt of power. I'm running 180 watts on my car, sideband. And we were talking all the way. And as I'm driving along the freeway, I had a switch in the car where I could flip back and forth rapidly between the two antennas. And when I'm down on the freeway at normal altitudes, and I'm listening to the normal flutter, horizontal and vertical polarization, for his horizontal transmission to me, horizontal and vertical polarization in my automobile sounded the same. If I stopped in one particular location, and I had a no for horizontal, and I flipped for vertical, most of the time the no went away, and vice versa. But while I'm rolling, and I'm hearing the flutter, there was essentially no difference between horizontal and vertical, until I got to a scenic overlook, where I could look for 20 miles. Then the horizontal was a hell of a lot stronger, because he was transmitting horizontal. But when that signal tips through the trees, and mountains, and water towers, and buildings, and everything else, to get to me down at normal level on the thruway, by the time that signal got to me, it didn't have any clearly defined polarization. So that's what I saw on 2 meters. I think there could be a somewhat similar effect on 10 meters. But it would be a lot of fun to have a mobile rig where I can flip back and forth between a horizontal 10-meter antenna and a vertical 10-meter antenna when I'm talking to your repeater. That would be a fun experiment when I'm driving 50 miles, 100 miles, 200 miles from your repeater. Repeater's going to be a little bit different. He was aiming a pretty high gain array at me, and that's how we were covering the 200 miles. And by the way, when I'm on go up Route 87 toward Albany, go over to the west on Route 90, and I'm on the north side of that set of mountains, and so that poor signal was not only going 200 miles, it was going over a local set of mountains, and then down into the valley where I was in Route 90, as I was driving from Albany to Utica and talking to him all the way. And to try to figure out how that poor signal got through all that jazz is a nightmare. But boy, it did it. Radiate enough power, and it gets there. Back to you for any further comments on this, Howie. K2RIW.
All right, Dick, if you now go to smaller antennas like a tenth of a wave or any other antenna, you start stacking them. Now, would you say that you still will get the same situations if you try to stack antennas, small antennas?
Negatory. Yes and no. You gotta be careful now. If I had full half-wave vertical dipoles, they have a certain effective capture area. I make an infinitesimal dipole. I don't care if it's a loop, dipole, or whatever. I make an extremely physically small antenna. But carefully, with high efficiency, resonated and impeded. The magic of the way antennas work, small antennas, is that because of the high Q of the resonance, even though the antenna is physically small, it electronically re-derives 90% of the exact same area. Of course, that's hard to believe. It doesn't. I do that experiment day in and day out as an occupation. See that answer over and over again. By now, I believe it. Read the right chapter of Krauss's book, you'll believe it. So-called infinitesimal dipole chapter. And as I said, Mel and I are getting a lot of hate mail on this one. People think that we're charlatans and
telling a, you know, the world's most wicked lie that we're saying this, because it's been so ingrained in so many hams talking to each other about this theory that they don't measure. They just pass the theory back and forth, and everybody believes it. So, see, the small antenna has the same area within 90%. Therefore, whatever stacking distance you use for a halfway dipole, you're going to use the exact same stacking distance with small loops and small dipoles. The same stacking distance, roughly halfway stacking distance. You can stack them closer if you want to. The effective areas will overlap, and you're not going to get the benefit. There's at least two reasons why you're going to stack them darn close to a half wavelength. You don't want the areas to overlap so that the extra hardware really does something for you. And when you stack them half wavelength, you start narrowing up the vertical beamlets if you're stacking them vertically, and you're creating a pancake pattern, and that can be very desirable. So again, you're falling into the trap, Howie. You think that a small antenna must have a small area. Therefore, you can stack it closer together. You see there's a double error there. Back to you, Howie. T2LIW.
I understand. I was just asking you. Okay. I mean, if you had to pick an antenna, what would you go with? Something like a big wheel, a global leaf, a turnstile, if you were picking your dollars and cents?
Okay, the so-called hula hoop antenna really was a bent half wave into a circle. And it had some wow to it. By wow, I mean you sweep it in azimuth, and there were peaks and valleys to that pattern. Only when you make the loop something like a tenth or 0.15 wavelength in circumference does it become truly omni. Same pattern, but now omni. It doesn't have nulls in the pattern. But it's a bit more difficult to impedance match it. Once you accept that, the so-called magic of the cloverleaf and some of these other exotic-looking things is that people think that, gee, I'm putting more wire out there, therefore I got more area, therefore I got more gain. I think you see where we're going here. We've been sucked in. Does a cloverleaf antenna, with all the extra hardware on top of the car, does it have more gain than a tenth wavelength circumference loop properly tuned to that frequency? The answer with an half dB is no. Of course it doesn't make sense. With all that hardware for a clover loop leaf and all the other, I don't care if it's a three-leaf clover, four-leaf clover, whatever, you're putting up a whole lot of horizontally polarized hardware, and it looks like a massive antenna, and boy, that's got to have a lot of gain. And a tiny little tenth wavelength, 0.15 wavelength circumference loop, it's got to have very little gain. Well, if you, with high efficiency impedance match it, the effective area of one versus the other is 90%, half the dB. Do you really want to put up all that hardware? Now, putting up all that hardware, that particular approach may be a little bit more broadband. It does not have more gain. Within that half dB difference. Back to you, Harry.
Remember, this is not going to be on a mobile. This is going to be on a tower. It's going to be at a repeater site. So it's not going to be on a car. I'm just trying to see which would... What I want is just get a nice pattern so you can hear, you know, you can get the DX from the south, the east, to the west. You can get the various different DX. All right. I am going to look at some of the... I may even give that guy a call and see if he, what his antennas are like. I definitely like to go to a DC ground. I know there's a company in Alabama that makes an antenna. I forgot what they call it. It's supposed to be a little bit longer than a halfway, but it's not grounded. I don't know if you know what company I'm talking about.
I may have seen it, but I don't think I do. And by the way, there's a slight exception to what I said. In the case of antennas that are closer to half wavelength or more in circumference, you definitely have a wow to the pattern. So it peaks and valleys in azimuth. When you put three of them displaced every 120 degrees, which is one of the ways of building a three-leaf clover antenna, you do fill in some of those nulls. So a lot less of the wow of gain versus azimuth, a lot less of it is there with a clover leaf than a full half-wave or whatever loop antenna. But the gain is within half a dB. That's a lot of hardware you've got to put up there in the case of mobile.